أشهد أن محمد رسول الله
As-salamu alaykum and welcome once again to Islam in Focus. Today's program is the 43rd in the series Sources of Islam, and to be more specific, it's the 11th segment on the authenticity of the Quran. I'm your host, Rashad Manoush, and here for me from St. Mary's University, Dr. Jamal Bergdawi. As-salamu alaykum, Dr. Jamal.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
For the benefit of our viewers, could you give us a summary of last week's program, please?
Certainly. Last week was the third segment that deals with the specific issue of the arrangement of the Quran, and we began by discussing some of the theories that try to explain the pattern of the arrangement of the various surahs in the Quran, especially the opinions given by Orientalists. We began first with the suggestion that the Quran is ordered more or less by the length of the surahs, and we indicated by numbers and figures that this is an erroneous explanation. It was indicated that the Quran is not organized like chapters either, that is by topics. We discussed the suggestion that the Quran was collected in a haphazard way, and we indicated that this is a very erroneous statement, and we indicated that some of the critics of Islam, even like the New Catholic Encyclopedia, rejected this notion. We then turn to the question as to who then determined the order of the Quran, and we indicated that all historical and logical evidence seem to show that the order of the verses in the Quran, of the ayat or the passages, was definitely in accordance with the instruction of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and that he in turn has done that on the basis of the revelation or instruction of Angel Gabriel. And this is a matter that there have been absolutely no difference on whatsoever, unanimous. As far as the order of surahs, quote-unquote chapters, that's not a very good word, but the order of surahs in the Quran, we discussed the three different opinions on that, and we indicated that the consensus really is that there seemed to be more evidence, stronger evidence, that even also in the case of surahs, the order in which they appear in the Quran today was also in accordance with the instructions of Prophet Muhammad, and we indicated why that is the strongest. But as far as the verses, there are unanimity on that.
Now, it's come to my attention that some writers claim that the third Khalifa, that being Osman, was not sure about the order of two chapters. Now, this doesn't sound very right to me. I'd like your opinion on it, and maybe you can comment on what the basis of their claim is.
In fact, there is a report to that effect, but it is not a very authentic report. It is not. In some collection about the saying of Prophet Muhammad, like Ahmad, and maybe others like Abu Dawood, Tirmidhi, and Nasa'i, there have been a report attributed to Ibn Abbas, a companion of the Prophet, that he once said to the third caliph, Osman, he said, why did you, in the final compilation or putting together of the various manuscripts, why did you put surah number 8 in that particular order and put 9 after that, and why you have opted for this particular order? It is said, according to that less authentic report, I should say, that Osman, the caliph, answered, and he said that whenever verses or passages of the Quran were revealed to Prophet Muhammad in long surahs, long chapters, that whenever a portion was revealed, he used to invite or get someone who used to write or to whom he used to dictate the revelation, and he said to him, place this passage or these few passages in such and such surah where it says such and such, in other words, determining where exactly this particular part fits in any particular surah and where it should be put from beginning to the end. And then it says that Osman continued to explain, and he said that surah number 8, called Al-Anfal, was among the first surahs that were revealed in Medina, to which the Prophet migrated from Mecca. And he said that number 9, on the other hand, was among the latest or the last that was revealed to the Prophet in Medina. And he says, I noted that the topic in both of these surahs, number 8 and 9, is very similar. So I thought it is part of it. But since the Prophet died without explicitly indicating to us that this is a separate surah, or whether they are the same since the topic is similar, I put them, or I placed them in the Quran in that particular order, and I did not write between these two surahs, number 8 and 9, the common line that usually appear in the beginning of every surah, that is Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. That as far as the report itself goes. But if we examine that report in terms of authenticity, we find that many scholars of hadith, that is the saying of Prophet Muhammad and things that were narrated about him or about Sahaba, his companions, found that this report is not very strong. According to Bukhari, perhaps the greatest collector of the saying of the Prophet, he said that one of the narrators in that hadith is a man by the name of Yazid al-Farisi. And he said that this person cannot be taken really as a very trustworthy narrator. Other contemporary scholars of prophetic saying, like Ahmad Shakir, for example, they even go to the point of saying that this is baseless hadith. It doesn't have really a very strong origin. In other words, without getting into the technicalities, what I'm saying is that the specialist examining the report found it less than authentic in terms of the narration. But on the other hand, even if we assume for the sake of discussion that the report is correct, as Jalaluddin Suyuti, one scholar of the Quran, for example, thought, all it says really is that the order of the various surahs in the entire Quran has been done in accordance with the command of the Prophet, with the exception of number 8 and number 9. And like I say again, even if that less than authentic report is correct, that doesn't really deal with the entire order of the various surahs in the Quran. But I didn't just want to make an overgeneralization with respect to the order of surahs, even if there is such a weak report. I think the viewers are entitled to get both sides of the argument or the picture.
Now, putting aside the actual question of authenticity, whether it's the authenticity of this report, does this have any theological implication, or any implication related, for example, with the authenticity of the Quran?
No, none whatsoever. All it could say or imply, if it were true, is simply that the order in terms of the surahs, that these two quote-unquote chapters, surahs, whether they used to be one, or were it originally one chapter, or are they two separate chapters but with similar topic. But in terms of subject matters, in terms of the contents, it doesn't affect neither the content of the Quran nor even the order of other surahs in the Quran. The question is only related to that particular two surahs. In addition to this, there is more than one reason to believe that the order of the surahs in the Quran includes also these two surahs, if you really read history and try to analyze it. Number one, in the life of the Prophet, there have been so many memorizers of the Quran, and it is well known that they used to memorize the Quran also in the order that the Prophet instructed, that this are the supposed to be the order of the surahs. And as such, those memorizers must have memorized in that particular order, and there have been no dispute about their memorization of the Quran or their consensus on that particular order. Number two, even though surah number 9, which came after 8 and where the question was raised, was revealed in a later time in Medina, we all know that in the very last year of the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the angel of revelation, Gabriel, came to him and reviewed the entire Quran twice. Every year it used to be once, but that year it was reviewed twice. And there were some companions present when Gabriel was checking on the Prophet in terms of the proper memorization of the Quran. Well, the Quran was nearly complete at that time, and obviously the review was done in the order of the surahs in the presence of those companions. A third reason is what explains the agreement of early Muslims who were eyewitnesses to this whole process of revelation and who were living still and who all agreed to this particular order of the surahs in the Quran. Definitely, it must have something to do with what they heard the Prophet himself reciting every day in the prayer or in other occasions. So they must have memorized the same way the Prophet recited. In addition to this, as we indicated in some earlier programs, that the compilation of the Quran, or putting the various manuscripts together in one volume, because everything was written in the lifetime of the Prophet, was not done arbitrarily, or was not done even by one person, Osman the Third Caliph, but by a committee, you might say, a committee of very well-known, knowledgeable, and trusted companions of the Prophet. Many were actually the eyewitnesses to the revelation of the Quran, and many others, other than the committee even, were present, who were contemporaries of the Prophet, and who have heard the Quran before. I might even add one remark here that some scholars pointed out too, and that the fact that chapter 9, or surah number 9, does not begin with the line, normal or the common line, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, that shows an absolute accuracy and honesty of Osman, the third caliph, and all of that committee. Because even though it appears to be two surahs, but since he didn't specifically hear the Prophet recite and stop and repeat that line to show that there is a new surah to be revealed, a new unit altogether, shows that how honest they were in not trying to apply their own judgment. Actually, this is a vindication even of Osman and those companions.
And how meticulous with detail.
Exactly, even the slightest detail, because they know this is the word of Allah, they don't want to take any step to tamper with it, even with good intention. That's really amazing, and I'm not familiar with any similar accuracy in any other book in the history of humanity.
May Allah reward them. Now, Dr. Jamal, we've discussed a number of questions related to the arrangements of the Quran. Is there anything that we've missed?
Well, there are a couple of points perhaps that might be relevant here. In a previous program, we discussed the attempt on the part of one of those who translated the Quran. He's a non-Muslim by the name of Dawood. His translation is quite common. Who printed a translation of the Quran and differed from the 1400 years old tradition that had been followed by putting a different order of the surahs, beginning with what he considered to be poetic surahs, or you know, shorter ones mainly. And in fact, Dawood was acting in a similar way to many other Orientalists who tried to formulate their own theories about the order of the surahs in the Quran. And in fact, there is a good summary to many of these theories in a book that, while it was printed by Longman in 1983, it came to my attention only a few days ago, and I was very glad to find that the methodology used by the writers seemed to be quite similar to what we have been following throughout this particular program relating to the authenticity of the Quran. It's written by Dr. Muhammad Khalifa, and the title is The Sublime Quran and Orientalism, which is an interesting, very useful book from which we can benefit a great deal in this type of program. It's an asset. Dr. Khalifa indicated that the objections raised by some Orientalists about the order of the Quran seem to go back to the Dark Ages or Middle Ages. He quotes, for example, Ricoldo, R-I-C-O-L-D-O, Ricoldo, who described the Quran as, quote, fabricated, torn about, and disorderly. Well, one can perhaps understand the medieval Dark Ages circumstances which might have led Ricoldo to make a statement like that, the spirit of the Crusades and antagonism between the the Muslim world and the Christian world at that time. But the thing that is rather difficult really to understand is why should many writers and Orientalists in our day and age, in the 20th century, continue to perpetuate this kind of prejudices without even checking their validity. They just copy what has been said before and never bother really to do any scholarly original research to find out what was the basis even of those medieval or Dark Age type of statements. And they try to present theories which are erroneous and lacking in evidence and many times even totally baseless.
Now, can you explain to us some of the objections that you may have, or the objections that they may have, mm-hmm. and why? Why are they erroneous?
Let's take a couple of examples from the book I mentioned, Dr. Khalifa's The Sublime Quran. For example, he refers to J. Winsbrough in his Quranic studies as saying that the Quran is a rough coordination which probably developed over a long period of time, perhaps 200 years, that the collection of the Quran or compiling took about 200 years. This is a clear example of error. Why? Winsbrough here did not only contradict all overwhelming historical and logical proofs that has been discussed to just replace it with his own guesswork, but it appears like Dr. Khalifa suggests that he didn't even understand the difference between Quran and Hadith. Because the Quran is the word of Allah, Hadith is the saying attributed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And in fact, historians say that while there have been some early writings of the saying of the Prophet, it was not collected systematically until approximately 200 years after the Prophet. But the Quran, we have seen, has been totally and completely written in the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad and collected only a few years. Within the second year, even after his death, everything was compiled in the first collection by Abu Bakr. So apparently there seemed to be that mix of confusion between Quran and Hadith, and definitely Hadith is not part of the Quran. So the error is so obvious and manifest, really. A similar allegation was made by R. Bell, B-E-L-L, who claimed again that by his study of the structure of the Quran, he found evidence that there have been some revisions and alterations to some passages, and even says that some passages do not fit in the rhyme of the Quran, and end up saying, quote, that the Quran is a multitude of disconnected pieces, sudden changes of subject, even grammatical break. If what Bell is saying were true, then why is it that there is absolutely no trace in history, which is very detailed, by the way, you have seen in the past programs how detailed history was given about the Quran, even about one verse, one word even, and everything was mentioned in detail. Why in all of that detailed history we fail to find a single evidence of revision or any remains of the original that was revised, and in what sense it differs from those revised? Nor does he provide any substantive evidence as to who dared tamper with the word of Allah and try to revise the word of Allah or introduce anything different into it, an act which is regarded as a great blasphemy, which is condemned very strictly in the Quran itself. Let us look at an example of what he claimed to be disconnected. He refers, for example, to Surah number 84, particularly in passages 7 through 12. And he says that when you come to 12, the meaning is connected. However, if you take the following verses, the following passages from 13 to 15, he says that these three are not really connected with the meaning, and probably they were later additions. But if you really review what Bell is saying. Of course, it's difficult now without going into details, but I just give the reference and anyone can check it, even in a translation of the Quran, let alone the original. If you check these passages, that is 84 from 7 to 15, you will find that if there is any disconnection, it's probably disconnection in his own understanding rather than in the Quran itself. Because to summarize the content from verse 7 or passage 7 to 12, basically it deals with the description of the status of human beings in the Day of Judgment, that those who are good will receive their book, the book of their deeds, in the right hand, which is a good omen, a good sign, that their accountability will be easy, that they will come back rejoicing. On the other hand, it says that those who receive their book of deeds from behind their back, which is a bad sign, it means that they will enter into the blazing fire. And then describe those people who will be thrown into the blazing fire, that in the earthly life, these people used to be rejoicing among their people. They thought that they will not be questioned, they will not be held accountable before Allah, who was ever watching over them. Well, is there any disconnection there? Describe the state of affair in the Day of Judgment, talking about the good, talking about the bad, describing why these people ended up in that or landed in that particular situation. It's that because of their behavior in this life. But according to Bell, he cannot see that connection. And he says that since part of the passage deal with the hereafter, part deal with this life, then there must be a disconnection. So which this is not true at all.
And very irresponsible.
I would say it's not a very responsible statement to say, you know, without, you know, giving any substantive, evidence or proof. Some of them even went as far as claiming that by analyzing the style or rhyme of the Quran, they discovered even variations, not in meaning, but variations even in the style, and they tried to imply that, well, the Quran that we have today is not accurate.
Now, I appreciate, Dr. Jalal, that explaining these aspects in English may be a bit difficult, maybe more than just a bit difficult, maybe very hard to do. But for the benefit of at least some of our viewers, maybe you can give us a few references or examples which actually may be checked or verified.
No problem. Take, for example, the statement made by J.M. Rodwell, R-O-D-W-E-L-L.
Mm-hmm.
Rodwell made a very fantastic claim, you know, that the surahs or the chapters in the Quran should be ordered really from the, should be ordered from shortest to longest. And he says that the earlier surahs were short surahs. And try to show and prove how the present arrangement of the Quran in his mind is not correct. But in the process of doing so, he seemed to have, as Dr. Khalifa say, forgot to check his own arithmetics. For example, he says that in surah number 67, he says passages 8 through 11 seem to have been a later insertion. Why? Because he says that these passages are relatively longer, and that's not the case with early surahs. Early surahs were normally short type of verses. What Rodwell seemed to have forgotten is that the number of words in these four verses are exactly 13, 19, 12, and 5, and that gives an average of over 12 words per passage or per verse. Whereas in the rest of the surah, that's surah number 67, the average of words range between 8 to 18. So where is the substantial difference in the average length? That indicates that there is absolutely no basis whatsoever to single out these particular passages and say that they are different from the others, just on the basis of mathematics, really. Just the arithmetics even would do it. The same inaccuracy is in his claim that the word saqar, which appear in Surah 74 in passages 26 and 27, disturbs the rhyme. Well, as you mentioned earlier, perhaps it might be difficult to explain it, convey the meaning from one language to the other. But I would invite all the viewers to just even hearing it in Arabic and judging whether there is any disturbance in rhyme. ثم أدبر واستكبر فقال إن هذا إلا سحر يؤثر إن هذا إلا قول البشر سأصليه سقر وما أدراك ما سقر لا تبقي ولا تذر. That's the word that you object, سقر. Where is the difference or disconnection in the rhyme? The unfortunate thing is that Radwell is addressing an audience or viewers who do not know Arabic, and he can make statements as he like, but there is not much of a chance for many readers about Islam from the wrong sources discovering and discerning the correct from the erroneous.
Now, how about maybe commenting on some other objections that you referred to a little earlier, in particular dealing with the flow of meaning, and maybe it'd be good idea to give an example with it.
Okay, let's take the same writer, for example, Radwell.
Okay.
Similarly, a famous writer who wrote about the Quran erroneously also, Arthur Jeffrey. Beginning with Radwell, for example, he says that in Surah number 51, he says or claims that the passage is 24 towards to the end, that is to 60, were not part of that surah, but his judgment again was never based on any historical evidence, because according to his own understanding or his own interpretation, he feels that there is no logical flow of meaning. Now, again, that judgment reflects not only his lack of understanding of the style of the Quran and the continuity in its meaning, which is rather unique, but more specifically, if we refer to the surah itself, you will notice that the part that he considers to be, the original part of the surah, 51, passages 1 through 23, deal basically with the basic idea that the promise of Allah is true, the day of judgment is true. It describes the state of people who rejected faith in the day of judgment. It compares that with the believers and the God-conscious people, and simply ends by saying that there are many signs in the earth and in oneself and in the universe at large which shows that this Quran is true, and that there are lessons for us to learn. That's the part that he considered. Mm-hmm. The other part that he considered disconnected, indeed, that's from 24 to 60, simply continues to describe those lessons. In other words, the first part says there are lessons for us to learn. The remaining part of the surah describes those lessons, that is, lessons about the punishment of those who rejected faith and truth in the past in the story of different prophets. Lessons from the creation of the earth and other living things, lessons pertaining to the various signs of Allah's power in the universe, and end up simply by inviting people to have faith in Allah. It consoles or comforts the Prophet when he was rejected, that this is natural for prophets to receive this kind of treatment. This is not the only example of this kind of lack of understanding, but I hope that it might give some idea that one should be careful.
Well, it does sound like a drastic claim, though. You know, I wonder on what basis he actually made that claim. But I think you've explained that quite well. Thank you very much. And thank you all for joining us here on Islam in Focus. We appreciate our viewers, and please join us here next week again for Islam in Focus. From all of us, Assalamu alaikum.
أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد